12 miles from all land in the German seas, there lieth a great hidden rock called Inchcape. Very dangerous for navigators because it is overflowed at every tide. In olden times upon this said rock was a bell fixed upon a timber which rang continually, being moved by the sea, giving notice to the sailors of danger. But it was taken down by a sea pirate who one year thereafter did himself perish upon that same rock with ship and goods in the righteous judgment of God.
Sweat and inspiration. Five engineering feats from the 19th century. Compiled by Martin Wirth from original material and presented by civil engineer Dr. Mark Race. Programme 1, The Lighthouse.
Britain's always been a maritime nation, and in the 19th century, she was very determined to rule the waves. So the importance of lighthouses, warning of the dangers on her coasts, can't be underestimated. One such lighthouse is the one on the Bell Rock, off the east coast of Scotland, standing almost 12 miles out to sea on the top of a submerged rock, a rock that had terrified seamen for centuries.
Placed right in the fairway of two navigations, it breathed along the whole coast an atmosphere of terror and perplexity. And no ship sailed that part of the North Sea at night, but what the ears of all those on board would be strained to catch, the roaring of the seas on the Bell Rock.
From Admiral Sir Alexander Cochrane. This rock is placed in the most dangerous situation possible. Covered early in the tide, the soundings are no guide whatever, for within a mile of the rock, the depth of the water is 32 fathoms. So a ship standing in for the shore runs the utmost danger of being wrecked.
When mariners at sea are overtaken with a storm, they make for the most contiguous shelter, but are often known to avoid the Firth of Forth on account of the Bell Rock, which, like another Cerberus, guards its entrance. Of this, we had a melancholy example in that heavy gale last winter.
50 or 60 vessels were cast away. Had they been able to attempt the safety of the Firth of Forth, many lives and much property would have been preserved. The dread, however, of the Bell Rock induced them instead to haul to the northwards and encounter seas surpassed in few places on the globe.
From the experience I have in cruising on this coast, I give it as my most decided opinion that the greatest good in consequence will arise to the traders of Scotland were a lighthouse erected on it.
Coming down now, the helicopter pad seems incredibly small. Fortunately, I know these guys know what they're doing. The lighthouse itself doesn't look that big, actually. I don't know how it survives all the waves. Coming into land now.
We've flown out to the Bell Rock Lighthouse with the engineers from the Northern Lighthouse Board. And we've only got an hour before the tide comes back in, covering the rock and the helicopter landing pad. It gives you an idea how hard it was to build a lighthouse here in 1810 and makes you appreciate what they managed to achieve with the simplest of tools, more or less a pick and a shovel. As an engineer myself, I have to admit that it would be difficult to build a lighthouse here even today. And we have the advantages of modern technology. The credit for this achievement belongs to a remarkable engineer called Robert Stevenson, who worked for the Northern Lighthouse Commissioners.
The mind of my grandfather had long been exercised with the idea of putting a light upon this formidable danger, and he was ever a practical man. But to build a tower 11 miles from shore on a rock that is barely uncovered even at low tide was something yet unattempted, unessayed.
The Eddiston Lighthouse had already been built by John Smeaton, out to sea off Plymouth, and was considered one of the greatest engineering achievements of its time. so much so that it was included in the crest of the Institution of Civil Engineers. But not even John Smeaton's lighthouse had been built on a rock that was submerged twice a day at high tide, let alone to a depth of 11 feet. Robert was confident that he could solve the problems, but because he was relatively young, only in his 30s, the Northern Lighthouse Commissioners took the step of asking John Rennie, an eminent civil engineer, to oversee the project.
Mr. Stevenson, to whose merit I am happy to bear testimony, has proposed various ingenious methods of construction, but after comparing these with the way Mr. Smeaton's lighthouse was built, there is undoubted proof of the stability of the Eddystone, so I am inclined to give that the preference. I am not accompanying this report with the design of such a lighthouse. It will be time enough for that when the commissioners give orders for its erection, when, I have no doubt, Mr. Stevenson will furnish me with such valuable matter towards the perfecting of it.
The appointment of Rennie must have annoyed Robert, but it's certainly common practice now for engineers to have their designs checked by others before they're approved. It was arranged for a lightship to be moored near the rock, which meant that dues could be collected from shipping which benefited from it. This was used to help pay for the project, and, as Robert saw, had other advantages too.
The floating light should be fitted up as a storeship with accommodation for the artisans. But since it will have to be moored about a mile off to allow enough sea room to clear the rock in the event of her breaking adrift, the greatest advantages would arise if a temporary residence for the artisans could later be erected on the rock itself.
What Robert had in mind was a hut standing on stilts above the sea, a bit like the accommodation platforms built next to the oil rigs in the North Sea. Rennie was startled by the idea. Smeaton would never have contemplated anything so hazardous when building the Edison Lighthouse. But he had to admit it made sense. In their joint report to the commissioners, it's clear they differed about what mattered most, and it's easy to see which parts were written by Rennie and which by Stevenson.
Should this project of a residence for the artisans on the rock fail, the timber and iron can be applied to other uses, and the expense of this experiment need not be great. As to the construction of the lighthouse itself, we are of the opinion it is much better to follow what has been found to be an answer at the Eddystone than to look for other methods that have not stood the test of time.
It must be observed, however, that the Bell Rock is of softer quality than that of the Eddystone, so the base of the tower will need to be more extended, that the waves may spend their fury on the lighthouse itself instead of wearing away the rock on which it stands.
Robert was responsible for both the design of the lighthouse as well as the construction. It would be very different now. Someone would design it and a different company would build it, although we are seeing signs of a shift back to what are called design and construct contracts. Robert respected Rennie, and he often sought his advice, but he had his own plan of action.
1. The floating lightship be fitted out and in place for the men before the work can start. 2. The necessity of finding a workyard in Arbroath as the port most contiguous to the rock. 3. Two vessels for conveying stones, strong and of good materials. A crane at Arbroath and at the rock.
4 fenders, 4 tongs, 4 pokers, fire irons.
While his foremen were busy checking inventories of equipment, Robert was in Arbroath setting up a workyard and ordering the granite he needed from the quarries.
4 tankards, 2 tinder boxes.
We hereby offer to furnish 2,000 tons of such quantity of stones as may be required on the following terms. To be taken in the rough state, 1 shilling per cubic foot. We hereby agree to pay for the transport and to load the same onto vessels.
44 picks, 11 stone axes. 11
Dear Mr. Stevenson, as to your method of keeping the courses together compared with that done by Mr. Smeaton, we will talk over that when we meet. I trust you will then be able to convince me of the superiority of your plan, or I shall satisfy you respecting Mr. Smeaton's.
8 gallons linseed oil.
With all he had on his plate right now, Robert could have done without Rennie making technical comments on his designs. But one of the hallmarks of a good engineer is the ability to argue the merits of your own case. It's also true that a certain amount of tension within a design team can produce a better result. At last the lightship was ready, and Stevenson began recruiting his men. He probably didn't tell them how seasick they were going to be, although he made it a condition that they must stay at least a month, knowing they'd have found their sea legs by then. But he did warn them he expected them to work on Sundays at double pay. The men weren't so sure about this. It went against their consciences. But the double pay helped.
In consequence of our communion with one another, we hereby agree to take up, Tom, that whatever work may start up concerning the Bell Rock business, the terms of our agreement to be 20 shillings a week, summer and winter, wet and dry, with free quarters and likewise our victuals when we are at the Rock. As for the Sunday's work and premiums, we leave that to the honour of our employers.
Almighty and ever-blessed God, thou art not confined to temples made with hands.
To ease their consciences, Robert asked a minister in Edinburgh to compose a special prayer.
Even here, where no temple invites, be with us and strengthen us to discharge the duties of thy holy day.
Throughout the whole of the operations, it was observable that the men worked more keenly than ever on Sundays, from the impression they were engaged in work of imperious necessity.
The adoration of thee, whose word alone spake the universe into being.
Monday, the 17th of August. The tide falling late, our party, counting 24 in number, embarked from our broth about 10 o'clock p.m., Our ship's colours have been flying all day in compliment to the commencement of the work. The other vessels in the harbour also saluted, and many friends and acquaintances collected on the piers. As we cleared the harbour, all on board united in giving hearty cheers which were returned by those on shore in such good earnest that in the still of the evening they must have been heard in all parts of the town, re-echoing from the walls and turrets of the venerable abbey of Aberbrothwick.
At six the next morning, as the ebbing tide exposed the rock, the men were landed from rowing boats and work began at once on digging the foundations for the Beacon House, the temporary residence for the men on the rock, the idea which had so alarmed John Rennie. It was to stand on six oak timbers, each 42 feet long, that would stick up from the rock at angles to form a giant pyramid, the top of which would be well above the level of the highest tide. The men hacked away at the rock, but it wasn't long before the tide came in swirling round their feet. As they rowed back to their berths on the lightship, the importance of getting those timbers erected must have been absolutely clear. At least it would give them something to cling on to if the worst happened. Soon they were rowing back, ready to start work with the next low tide. Their pickaxes quickly became blunt, so there was a blacksmith on hand to sharpen them on a forge he set up on a ledge.
Sometimes a sea comes rolling over the rocks to dash out his fire and endanger his indispensable bellows. I was often amused at his perplexing anxiety to avert the effects of the tide. As it rose by imperceptible degrees, he would work knee-deep in water till it blackened and extinguished his fire.
There couldn't have been a more graphic picture of man's battle against the elements. To keep up morale on the long haul, rowing between the lightship and the rock, Robert had the boats row races with each other. On Saturday nights, he had all hands served with a glass of rum, and alone in his own private cabin, listened to the men enjoying themselves. Once, the sloop that ferried them out to the rock had eight extra workmen on board. They landed in a rowing boat, which had no sooner got back to its parent vessel than a change in the weather sent them both drifting off together. It quickly dawned on Robert that there was no way the crew could tack back against the wind in time before the tide overflowed the rock.
In this perilous situation, I found myself with 32 persons and only two boats, which would not accommodate, even in good weather, more than 24 sitters between them. As the waters began to rise and the smith's fire was extinguished, the men began to make towards the boats and found only two instead of three. Not a word was uttered as they silently calculated their numbers and looked at each other with evident perplexity. They then looked steadfastly on me in the most perfect silence. The solemnity of the group made an impression never to be effaced. I attempted to speak, but my mouth was so parched I could not utter, and I learned that saliva is as necessary for speech as the tongue itself. But as I lapped some water from one of the pools, I heard a voice cry out,
"Aboard! Aboard!"
It was the mail boat bringing the men's letters. Even then it was a race against time to get everyone away before the rock was covered by the sea. Not surprisingly, the following morning, Robert found few willing to face the rock again.
The use of argument to persuade them would have been out of place. It is not the risk of the loss of a limb, but life itself that becomes the question. Notwithstanding the thinness of our ranks, we left for the rock at 6 a.m. in a gentle breeze. But on our return that night, the wind had shifted, and by midnight had become a gale of such force that every sea which struck the vessel caused all on board to tremble. Twice I was thrown upon the floor. About 2 o'clock, a heavy sea came pouring down into the berths, and the motion of the ship being suddenly deadened by the flowing in of the water, I doubt there was anyone who did not think the vessel was in the act of sinking. I groped my way to the galley, where several of the men were employed in prayer, repeating psalms and devotional exercises in a full tone of voice, while others protested that should they ever get on shore, no one would see them afloat again. The captain assured me we would soon have better weather, but every approaching wave looked as if it would overwhelm the vessel. On deck, I found one solitary individual, the seaman on watch, who was wearing no great coat or overall of any kind. He had lashed himself to the mast and told me with a smile he intended to wet as few clothes as possible so he'd have a dry shift when he went below. Seeing the confidence of these gentlemen and the smile of the watchman, though lashed to the foremast, I suddenly felt myself perfectly at ease.
10 days later, the holes they'd dug with their pickaxes were ready for the giant timbers that were towed out to them from Arbroath. The next day, in a race against the tide that had them working up to their waists in water, they managed to get 4 of the timbers up into a firm cone.
All hands spontaneously gave 3 hearty cheers. Even to this, a drowning man might take hold.
On my first visit to the rock, I found Mr. Stevenson with his workmen erecting a beacon. It consists of 6 main beams which form a pyramid 42 foot high with a base just as wide. Near the top are crossbars on which the smith's forge has been placed. The beacon points out to mariners the situation of the rock and serves as an asylum should the men be overtaken by the tide. I do not want to state particularly when the foundation course of the lighthouse will be laid, but I have great confidence in the zeal Mr. Stevenson has shown, and know he will do all he can to expedite the work.
In 1808, when work resumed after the winter, carpenters joined the team to turn the beacon standing up on its stilts into a proper wooden barracks for the men. And it wasn't long before a second smith was needed, as their pickaxes were getting so broken and blunted, excavating the foundations for the lighthouse. The blacksmith's forges were also needed to make the ironwork for a railway that was being laid across the rock to carry the stones, when they arrived, to the site.
The surface of the rock, being crowded with men, and the 2 forges flaming, one above the other, on the beacon from which volumes of smoke ascended, gave the whole a most fanciful appearance. The noise of the picks and thunder of the anvils rebounding against the occasional clamour of the surging seas.
Since the foundations were left flooded after every tide, the first half hour on the rock was spent bailing out, but at last they were ready for the foundation stone, which Robert laid with suitable ceremony.
May the great architect of the universe complete and bless this building.
The masons in Arbroath had long since been shaping the huge granite stones that arrived from the quarries. Owing to the tapering shape of the lighthouse, they had to be of a different size for each of the tower's 90 courses. The largest, weighing over a ton, they were loaded onto specially built barges to be towed to the rock.
Dear Mr. Stevenson, I have heard that Aberdeen granite has been much condemned. One whose opinion is not to be highlighted says there is not one building of any considerable age in Aberdeen that does not exhibit symptoms of decay. For his part, he would greatly prefer Kingurdy stone.
Dear Mr. Stevenson, in reply to your letter, Mr. Rennie has a partiality for the Kingurdy quarry, but I advise you to apply to the masons, as facts are the best arguments. The hard granite taken from the quarries seems everlasting in its nature.
Dear Mr. Stevenson, all the tackle for taking up the stones should be in preparation by now. You will not have any time to spare this summer, and I shall be glad if you will send me a drawing of the beacon house.
The ebb of the evening tide had little sea, but with the flood, it got up all at once as a thick fog came on. By the time we could get off, the waves on both sides, from south and north, were meeting while we escaped between them, to be sometimes lifted up and suddenly let down. It was midnight and thick weather. Each boat has a compass and blowing horn, and the schooner is provided with a bell and half a dozen horns, by which means we can find our way in fog. You can conceive what noise it makes when 9 horns and a large bell meet in clangor.
On my second visit to the rock, the tide did not allow me to examine the foundation so completely as I could have wished, but I was able to form a tolerable judgment. 17 stones have been let into the foundation to bring the whole level, and on this, the first course of 12 inches was laid in August and fitted very nicely into the rock. Each course since has been dovetailed in a mode somewhat different from that at the Eddystone, but on the whole, I feel confident that this work will be brought to a successful termination within a reasonable period.
31st of May, 1809. We have had not only hail and sleet, but on this, the last day of May, even snow to a depth of 3 inches. The wind has often shifted, yet it has never abated, nor the sea fallen in any degree.
Though the beacon house was almost complete, it still had to be roofed and was in no way furnished. But many of the men preferred to be stuck up there above the raging seas than endure the horrors of the tossing ship where Robert had his cabin.
Amid the hissing of the winds and the creaking of the bulkheads, rolling and pitching as we were, I spent the night in the most unpleasant reflections about how they were faring on the beacon. As soon as a boat could approach, I sent some cooked provisions and a kettle of mulled wine to the prisoners. They'd gone 30 hours without proper diet while exposed both to the wind and the sprays. On inquiry, however, it appeared that their spirits were much kept up by one of the joiners, who recounted to them tales of such hardship he had formerly endured at sea that by comparison their state on the beacon was one of comfort and happiness. When their food ran out, he told them he was once in a ship so disabled by a storm that they had nothing to eat but the rats that they could catch. By such means, he managed to cheer up the forlorn party.
Soon the beacon house was finished, and they extended a rope ladder from it to the growing tower of the lighthouse, which enabled the men to go to and fro regardless of the state of the tide. Mortar was conveyed from the mixers in the beacon house to the masons on the top of the tower with the help of a pulley. And even when the sea was at high water beneath them, work could go on at last all day.
July the 19th. The building has just attained the height of 16 feet. August the 12th. The building now 23 feet high. 20th of August. With the weather now favourable, 53 stones were landed and the builders not a little gratified on building the 22nd course, the first to be completed in a single day.
A few days later, with the completion of the 26th course, the granite tower stood 31 feet above the rock and 17 above the highest tides. The men were paid off for the winter and set sail for Arbroath.
The vessel being decorated with her colours and having fired a salute on approaching the harbour, a multitude of people assembled on the quays to greet us. Having made good wages, the men spent the evening with much innocent mirth and jollity. Always they went from Arbroath to their arduous task, cheering, and always returned in the same hearty state. At the rock, between tides, they amused themselves reading, fishing, playing music or cards, or sporting with one another. In the workyard at Arbroath, the young men were almost without exception employed in the evening at school. Not a few were learning architectural drawing, for which, in a very obliging manner, they were assisted by Mr. Logan, clerk of the works.
By June the following year, all the men lived in the beacon house, now fully fitted out with galley and furnishings. The rope ladder to the tower had been replaced by a bridge, and little notice was paid to whatever the sea was doing beneath them. Not that they were ever free from it. Waves at high tide would sweep up the base of the tower and drench masons working 50 feet up at the top. In July, after the 67th course had been laid, Robert went back to Arbroath to pay off the stonecutters whose 4 years of work was now over. There are mixed feelings at the end of nearly all long contracts, pride in the achievement, sadness and concern for the future. Robert gave £5 to the clerk of the works
for what is termed the finishing pint. With this sum, the stonecutters had a merry meeting in their barrack, collected the sweethearts and friends and concluded their labours with a dance. But the consideration of parting and of leaving a steady and regular employment to go in quest of work was rather painful after having been harmoniously lodged for years together in one large guild hall or barrack. so their happiness in this occasion was not without alloy.
A fortnight later, the 90th and last course of stone was laid, and all that remained was to build the light room on top. This had been mostly prefabricated in Edinburgh, along with the machinery for the revolving light that Robert had designed and been attending to during most of the winters. But even while it was being installed, the angry seas hit back.
The sprays were being carried over the masonry 90 feet above the level of the sea. At 4 o'clock this morning, it broke into the berths and all hands turned out to attend to their personal safety. The floor of the Smith's gallery was completely burst up and all the articles swept away. The cast iron mortar tubs, the iron hearth of the forge, the Smith's bellows and even his anvil thrown down upon the rock.
A lighthouse having been erected on the Inch Cape or Bell Rock, the commissioners hereby give notice that it will be lit from oil with reflectors placed at 100 feet above the medium level of the sea. The light will be exhibited on the night of February the 1st, 1811, and each night thereafter from the going away of daylight in the evening till the return of daylight in the morning. To distinguish it from others on the coast, it will revolve horizontally and exhibit a bright light of natural appearance and a red coloured light alternately, both maintaining their greatest strength for the space of every 4 minutes.
We're now standing in the light room at the top of the lighthouse. Today it's fully automatic, and the engineers very rarely come all the way out here. But in those days it had to be manned. On the very first night that this light shone out, there was a tremendous storm. Even the lighthouse keeper, in a letter to Robert, seems to have been surprised by the force of the sea.
It was as if, on the first lighting of the house, nature were making trial of the sufficiency of the building. Well, I paid particular attention to your directions as to whether I could feel the house shake. But I was not very sensible of this effect. There was a kind of vibration when the seas did not break till they reached the building, though it was not much more than the tremor produced by the striking of the alarm bells on the balcony. And you will form an idea of the force of the sea when I tell you that a large piece of lead that was used as a back weight for your crane, weighing a quarter of a ton, was lifted by the sea and carried a distance of 6 feet.
Robert's three sons followed in their father's footsteps and built lighthouses. His grandsons were engineers too, except one, who became a writer, Robert Louis Stevenson, the author of Treasure Island. He understood, as well as anyone, the kind of men who would, during the 19th century, transform the face of Britain.
My grandfather was first and last an engineer, but not in the field of engines. He was a projector of works in the face of nature. For the civil engineer, the complexity and fitfulness of nature are always before him. He has to deal with the unpredictable. His work, not yet in being, he must foresee its influence. How it shall deflect the tide, exaggerate the waves, or attract the thunderbolt. He must not only consider that which is, but that which may be.
Sweat and Inspiration was compiled and written by Martin Worth. It was presented by Dr. Mark Race. Bill Patterson played Robert Stevenson, and Paul Gregory was John Rennie. The other parts were played by Philip Anthony, John Badley, John Fleming, and James Telfer. The producer was Mark Savage.